U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions clashes with Democratic lawmakers over his refusal to detail his conversations with President Trump. This hour, where the Russia probe goes from here. Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our analysts today, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University. They will, of course, also comment on the shooting in Virginia this morning that injured Majority Whip Steve Scalise and others. Also, Trump's revised travel ban suffers another setback, why Panama abandoned Taiwan, and we'll ask our analysts what GOP senators have to keep in mind crafting their repeal and replacement of Obamacare. First, this hour's news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this Politics Wednesday. Joining us in our Ames studio, Jonathan Hasid, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Welcome back to our program, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Donna Hoffman is with us in our Cedar Falls studio, Department Head and Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hello, Donna.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Of course, we want to talk about the Jeff Sessions testimony yesterday, other things on our docket. To talk to you, Jonathan, specifically as a China expert in politics, to talk about why Panama abandoned Taiwan this hour, and some other China-related political news. Also a little later, these continued efforts by GOP senators to craft an Affordable Care Act replacement, repeal and replacement of Obamacare, that to come. Let's start off with the top of the hour news, only a few hours old. The suspect in the shooting that injured a congressman, a congressional aide, law enforcement officers. We heard at the top of the hour an Iowa angle on it, if you want to call it that. This suspect reportedly volunteering for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign here in Iowa. The Washington Post reporting this morning that the suspect, now dead, James T. Hodgkinson, volunteered in the Quad Cities area on the Sanders Iowa caucuses campaign. Hodgkinson was shot by police during the incident this morning. President Trump later announced that he died of his injuries. I want to make sure that our listeners know no members of Iowa's congressional delegation or staffers with their offices were present at the baseball game during the shooting. Let's listen to President Trump, part of a statement he made, very short, around 10:30 this morning, our time, saying the entire nation is praying for Majority Whip Steve Scalise.
Congressman Scalise is a friend. And a very good friend. He's a patriot and he's a fighter. He will recover from this assault. And Steve, I want you to know that you have the prayers not only of the entire city behind you, but of an entire nation and frankly, the entire world. America is praying for you and America is praying for all of the victims of this terrible shooting. I spoke with Steve's wife, Jennifer, and I pledged to her our full and absolute support, anything she needs. We're with her and with the entire Scalise family.
As we heard in the NPR news, it's too early to say whether this was an act of terror, an assassination attempt. But Donna Hoffman, let's get your reactions to this when something like this happens. What's on your mind as you hear the news?
Well, you know, it's important to remember at times like this, put this into perspective. America often has violent political incidents like this. If we, you know, obviously this was a member of Congress. Gabrielle Giffords previously survived an assassination attempt as a member of Congress. But even if we just look at presidents, there's only been 45 presidents in our nation's history. And four of those have been assassinated. Reagan came very close to being assassinated. Four others had serious assassination attempts. That's 9 of 45. That's 20%. of our president. And so there is something about America in terms of our history, in terms of our political culture, perhaps, that we have these events periodically. Other countries, generally speaking, don't have incidences like this. And, you know, it's kind of an interesting thought experiment to talk about, you know, why does this happen? But one of the things that we've talked about repeatedly when we've been talking on Wednesdays during the political show is kind of the denigration of political rhetoric in this country. But also, you know, we don't talk about public servants, and members of Congress are just that. They're public servants. We don't talk about them, generally speaking, as doing a good job. We often denigrate them. All public servants should be praised for the service that they do. But too often in America, that degenerates into not praise and talking about public servants in a very negative light that sometimes can feed these perceptions that people may have. And especially if you have somebody then that may be mentally ill or something to that effect.
Jonathan Haseeb, what's on your mind as we listen to the news developments and the shooting this morning?
Well, I certainly agree with Donna that, of course, you know, this sort of thing has happened repeatedly in the American past. But, you know, it does seem that the rhetoric is getting more heated now. And, you know, as she mentioned, with mentally ill people, this can set them off. And the rhetoric isn't just coming from one side. Iowa's own Steve King was reported in The Washington Post after the shooting as saying that this is the culture of the Democrats, is the culture of the left creating violence. And, of course, in this case, it was indeed apparently a Bernie Sanders supporter. But, of course, there's also plenty of overheated rhetoric from the right as well, when Donald Trump refers to the press as the enemy of the American people, and when, you know, Representative King says things like, we can't save our civilization with other people's babies. I think it's fair to say that both sides are really going off the rails here, and I suspect that, unfortunately, we're going to see more of this kind of thing. I don't, you know, this isn't a good sign for American democracy, though, of course, it's not unique.
Mm-hmm. Donna Hoffman, you mentioned Gabby Giffords. That was back in January of 2011. Shot in the head during an assassination attempt resulted in the deaths of six others in that shooting in Arizona. She survived, left her disabled, resulted in her resignation from Congress. She's become a vocal advocate for gun control. I wonder, Donna, if you think this is likely to spark renewed calls for gun control in today's political climate.
I think that's unlikely. And we've seen this with other shooting episodes. The political will is just not there. And in particular, I believe President Trump spoke about this in his statement. You know, he also attributes the fact that you had armed Capitol Hill police officers there as, you know, stopping that attack from being worse. And that oftentimes is some of the dynamic that comes into events like this, is that one side will often claim that we are safer if more people are armed because you can stop lone wolves, et cetera. And so it plays into the two-sided dynamic that we all already have in terms of gun control. And I think this is unlikely to be an event that sparks any kind of movement in terms of legislation.
Donna Hoffman is with us of the University of Northern Iowa. Jonathan Haseeb of Iowa State University, our Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Let's talk about the testimony yesterday. Yesterday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions denounced as a detestable lie his words, the idea that he colluded with Russians meddling in the 2016 election. He also clashed with Democratic lawmakers over his refusal to detail his conversations with the president. He had a series of tense exchanges with Democrats on the Senate Intelligence Committee. 2.5 hours or so of testimony. They pressed him on how to recount, pressed him to recount his discussions with President Trump. Before we get into hearing a couple of clips from that testimony, Jonathan, you start off. What were your takeaways mainly from that testimony yesterday?
Attorney General Sessions was very feisty in the hearing. And, you know, I do think that he successfully pushed off the collusion narrative that's been developing, the idea that Donald Trump personally or members of his campaign colluded with Russia. I mean, you know, as the Attorney General pointed out, there just isn't a lot of evidence for that particular claim. But it does nothing to stem the other problems, including potentially obstruction of justice involved in President Trump's firing of former FBI Director James Comey. In particular, Sessions was supposed to have recused himself from decisions involving investigations of either the Clinton or Trump campaign. That was what he said in his recusal statement. But by his own admission, he was still involved in the Comey firing. And of course, he gave a completely different rationale than President Trump did. When President Trump sat down for that interview with Lester Holt last week or a couple of weeks ago, the president said that he fired James Comey because of, quote, the Russia thing. And Sessions has essentially denied that. So there's, you know, quite a bit of daylight between the reasons given by President Trump's, you know, officials and underlings and the president himself. And I don't think this is going to make the obstruction of justice part go away. If anything, it'll make it worse.
Mm-hmm. What are your takeaways, Donna?
Well, and I think that when Sessions was particularly asked about his recusal, he gave a different reason than we commonly had assumed he had recused himself. It was merely that he had a personal connection with the Trump campaign, and that was the reason, not that, as Comey talked about in his testimony last week, that Sessions had contact with Kislyak, in particular the Russian ambassador. And so there were some interesting dynamics, I think, there in terms of how Sessions portrayed his recusal. And, you know, if it was true that he was recusing himself just because he had this personal connection with the campaign, then why didn't he do that earlier? You know, it was about a month in, I believe, after he was sworn in that he ended up having to recuse himself. And that was also kind of under some pressure due to some reporting about, in fact, despite his testimony in the Senate confirmation hearings where he said he didn't have any contact, there was then reporting that, he did. And so that was kind of a weird dynamic in terms of the reasons behind his recusal.
Mm-hmm. Democrats displeased with his answers, generally speaking. Republicans signaling yesterday that Sessions successfully, I guess, cleared up any confusion surrounding his interactions last year with Russian officials. So we have those two versions here. Let's listen to some of the contentious testimony yesterday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, pushing back against Senator Ron Wyden, of Oregon, his accusation of stonewalling during the committee hearing yesterday. He further explained that his actions met the standards dictated in the Department of Justice policy, speaking again about confidential conversations with the president.
General Sessions, respectfully, you're not answering the question.
Well, what is the question?
The question is, Mr. Comey said that there were matters with respect to the recusal that were problematic and he couldn't talk about them. What are they?
Why don't you tell me? There are none, Senator Wyden. There are none. I can tell you that for absolute certainty. This is a secret innuendo being leaked out there about me, and I don't appreciate it. And I've tried to give my best and truthful answers to any committee I've appeared before. And it's really people are suggesting through innuendo that I have been not honest about matters, and I've tried to be honest.
Mm. There's an example of how much of yesterday's hearing was devoted to Jeff Sessions' refusal to answer certain questions that he said endangered executive branch confidences. Jonathan Haseeb, what do you make of what's going on here? Explain what you see there.
Well, it's very interesting. Attorney General Sessions did not claim executive privilege, nor did the president. Attorney General Sessions merely said that the president at some future point might claim executive privilege, and so he used that as a blanket ban on talking about any of the conversations that he'd had with the president. But, of course, as Donna has pointed out, I mean, a lot of this doesn't make sense. If he recused himself because of ties to the Trump campaign, why did he wait so late? And why did he wait until media reports came out suggesting that he had met many times with the Russian ambassador, despite his claim under oath before the Senate in his confirmation hearings that he hadn't done so? So I think this is a good example to throw up lots of smoke and to try to confuse the issue. And I suspect that, we'll be hearing more from both Attorney General Sessions and indeed the president himself later on. I mean, if for example, it turns out that President Trump has indeed taped his interactions with James Comey, as he's hinted, then I suspect that eventually this will come out, and we'll see perhaps what it is that Sessions doesn't want to talk about.
Mm-hmm. And, Donna, what do you think is to come? It's hard to predict a day or two in advance. I'm asking a lot, I know, but in the weeks to come, do you have any idea where we're going here?
Well, I think the work of this Senate Intel Committee, which Sessions appeared before yesterday, will continue. We may not have as many high-profile, you know, events as we've had in the last 7 days or so with both Comey and Sessions testifying. But we also have to remember that there's the special counsel, Mueller, who is hiring people, whose investigation is going forward. We heard last week that he is in possession of the Comey memos that this particular Senate committee also wants but don't have apparently yet. And so there's different investigations that are going on. The special counsel's investigation in particular is likely to move pretty slowly, and Congress in general doesn't move quickly on things like this. And so I expect that we're going to get various revelations and various things coming out, different people testifying over the next part of the summer and, you know, probably even into the fall before this issue is finally set to rest in terms of what is known and what may never be known.
Mm-hmm. When we look at this through more of a partisan lens, do you see how each of the major parties are, what their strategies are here when we see now these two back-to-back high-profile testimonies, Jonathan?
Certainly. I mean, the Democrats are trying to tie members of the Trump administration to Russia and tie them to potential obstruction of justice claims. And, you know, the Republicans are trying to claim that there's nothing there and that, you know, this is all a Democratic smear. I mean, you know, the truth, we don't know yet. It will come out, I suppose, in the long run. But certainly both sides are playing hardball politics with this.
Let me ask you and play a cut that started the week off. It's hard to believe that this was Monday because so much news has happened in the meantime. On the PBS NewsHour on Monday, Christopher Ruddy, the CEO of a conservative media organization, Newsmax Media, said that the president could be weighing the termination of special counsel Robert Mueller, Mueller from his oversight of the federal Russia investigation. Let's listen to what was said on that Monday news hour.
Well, I think he's considering perhaps terminating the special counsel. I think he's weighing that option. I think it's pretty clear by what one of his lawyers said on television recently. I personally think it would be a very significant mistake, even though I don't think there's a justification. And even though, I mean, here you have a situation.
You don't think there's a justification for?
For a special counsel in this case.
Mm. So this comment set off a firestorm of reaction in Washington. Yesterday, the White House said that while the president has, in its words, every right to fire Mueller, he has no intention. The president has no intention of doing so. Let's get some of your reaction to this episode, because it's to those who don't study this, Donna, it's hard to decipher, can the president fire Robert Mueller now?
Well, not directly. And, you know, yesterday before Sessions testified, Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein actually testified before a different committee in the Senate, at which he said he would have to be the one that actually fired Mueller. The president could order him to do that. He said he testified that he wouldn't fire the special counsel without cause. And so seemingly if he would refuse to do that, he would probably resign. And some, I'm sure Trump could find someone else to do that. We've seen an incident like this in American history. It's typically called the Saturday Night Massacre in the Nixon administration, in which it was an independent investigator at this point, an independent prosecutor, that Nixon ordered the attorney general to fire. The attorney general didn't do so, resigned. The deputy also refused, also resigned, and it ended up being the solicitor general, Robert Bork, who ended up firing Archibald Cox. And so there would be we have already heard echoes of this when Trump fired Comey. And this is something that would be quite detrimental to the president to do. And after the Ruddy interview that you played the clip from that was on Monday, you did get a lot of discussion, I think, in Washington, D.C., in official Washington, D.C., a lot of commentary suggesting to the president that this would be a bad idea for him to do.
Bad idea. How much of a bad idea? So bad that some Republicans now backing or at least not heavily criticizing the president would jump ship?
That would be the potential. Now, again, the dynamics, the political dynamics of the early 1970s when Watergate was taking place and now are very different. But it could be a thing that would cause some Republicans to jump ship in terms of not supporting the president. This could be a clear evidence of obstruction of justice, if you will. And there's a danger in that because currently Trump has the support of key Republicans in the Senate, and they certainly can in the House, too, for that matter. And the Republican Party controls both chambers. At the point that some Republicans start to doubt the president in this regard, then Trump is in more political jeopardy. Currently, he's really not because he is maintaining the support of his party in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan Haseeb, do you think the firing of Mueller would have lost Trump the support of key Republicans?
Perhaps a few, but as Donna has said, you know, we're not in the early 1970s anymore. Society is much more politically polarized than it was. The parties seem to be much tighter coalitions than they were. And so I suspect that even if the president fired the special counsel, there would be some people in the GOP who would oppose it and perhaps very loudly. But I don't think that it would lead to impeachment, let's say, or, you know, so when Nixon did the Saturday Night Massacre, it was one of the key things that pushed members of the GOP into supporting impeachment hearings against him. I'm not sure that the same thing would happen today.
Mm-hmm. Donna, what are you hearing as far as the rationale that might have been used to fire Robert Mueller?
Well, Trump doesn't seem to actually be big on what the rationale would be. Other than, he has repeatedly talked about this episode with the Comey testimony. Comey talked about it as a cloud, Trump referring to it in that way as being a hindrance. And so it's an inconvenience to Trump at the moment. It's hindering his domestic political agenda in some ways. I've not really heard a rationale in terms of why he would do it, just that he could. And that is, you know, technically true, but it might not be wise politically. You know, we might also make a parallel here with what happened in the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday with Sessions' testimony. Repeatedly, Democratic senators said, "You're not answering our questions." You know, under what legal principle are you not answering our question? There was this, you know, non-privilege, executive privilege kind of that was brought up. There was also then some discussion of some internal documents from the Department of Justice. But Sessions, at the end of the day, did not answer those questions. And the Senate committee, you know, let that skate, let him go by in that regard. And so,
what leverage would they have had, though, other than to ask him to answer that? Even though executive privilege was not invoked.
They can do other things. Now, I'm not suggesting that they will do this because some of these things do skate by. But, you know, you can have contempt of Congress proceedings held and various other things. Typically, that's going to be something that then is in conjunction with someone claiming potentially executive privilege, which we didn't actually have invoked here. And so Congress or the Senate did not do those things. They did not put much pressure on Sessions to answer particular questions. They let him say, "I don't know," or they let him say, "I don't recollect," or that he couldn't answer those questions. And so that's kind of the nature of what, you know, we're in terms of the Washington environment, is that the Republicans are wanting to investigate the Russian matter. They've said so repeatedly in the Intelligence Committee anyway, getting to the bottom of it. But they're also reticent to push back on Trump too much as well.
Okay. We'll be back in just a moment with more from Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Jonathan Haseeb of Iowa State University. It's Politics Wednesday. Anything that you've been hearing in the last few minutes of analysis that you'd like to question or comment on, please join our discussion. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. When we come back, I want to lean on Jonathan Haseeb a little bit as we look to some political developments in China. For instance, why Panama announced this week it was cutting ties with Taiwan instead of establishing relations with China. Some background on that. Other political news out of Washington as well. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we've heard in the news about startups eyeing the market for space tourism. Also a lot also on this program about NASA discovering possibly habitable planets by the dozens. Well, with this backdrop, interplanetary vacations are suddenly not quite as far out as they once seemed. Tomorrow on this program, I'll talk with the authors of The Vacation Guide to the Solar System. These two authors, they've taken real data from NASA to create, a tongue-in-cheek, a sort of whimsical picture of what it would really be like to travel our solar system. So tomorrow, turn up at noon with your bags packed for a trip to the moon and beyond here on River to River. It's Politics Wednesday. Today on River to River with Jonathan Haseed of Iowa State University, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, our analysts picking apart the many happenings on the political landscape. A little bit later, we want to talk about efforts at the Affordable Care Act repeal and replacement, as well as the revised travel ban suffering another loss in the court system. But first, let me turn to you, Jonathan Haseed, as a China expert especially. We heard Panama announcing this week that it's cutting ties with Taiwan and instead establishing relations with China. Now, some of us who go back a few more decades remember the break that the U.S. made with Taiwan in the 70s under President Nixon. Give us some background here and the significance of this move. Why would this be important that Panama makes this move?
Yeah, it's a good question. To give some background, you have to go back to the Chinese Civil War in 1949, which the Nationalist Party, led by Chiang Kai-shek, lost. And then they fled to Taiwan. So Taiwan was the only part of China that wasn't taken over by Mao Zedong and the Chinese Communist Party. And that is the origin of Taiwan as an independent state. Its official name is still the Republic of China. It claims to be the official ruler of all of China, just, you know, in exile, essentially. The U.S. gave very strong support to Taiwan up through the 1970s, as you mentioned, Ben, very strong unofficial support since the 1970s. So, for example, in the United States, it's still governing law that we have something called the Taiwan Relations Act, which says that the U.S. is required to sell arms of a, quote, defensive character to Taiwan. And the U.S. has taken its informal defense commitment to Taiwan very seriously. So even though the U.S. doesn't recognize Taiwan as an independent country, the U.S. has gone out of its way to ensure the defense and safety of Taiwan against a potential Chinese invasion. So what's happened over the years is that more and more countries have dumped Taiwan in favor of China. The Chinese government says that you can only recognize one of the two. If you recognize Taiwan, you cannot get official recognition from the People's Republic of China. This maybe wasn't such a big deal in the 1980s when China was still quite poor, but of course now China is a major world power, and so you have increasing numbers of countries essentially bailing on Taiwan and going over to mainland China because they have to pick one or the other. And I don't know the details of the Panama case, but I'm sure that the Chinese offered some financial inducements for Panama to come on board. This is how it's worked in the past. In fact, in previous years, there have been bidding wars between countries. So 4 or 5 years ago, there was a bidding war for Liberia, and Liberia went back and forth between China and Taiwan until eventually I think they settled on Taiwan because they gave them more money and aid. But this is, this is from Taiwan's perspective, this is worrying because Taiwan is only recognized now by about a dozen or so countries around the world. And so, this is another one that they're losing. They don't have very many left.
Right. And this explains early on, I'm not sure if it was before the inauguration or was as President-elect Trump or President Trump when he received or made a call to the leader of Taiwan, right?
That's right. The newly elected president of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, called President Trump, President-elect Trump at the time. To the surprise of many, he took the call. In fact, he took the call before he'd ever spoken with the Chinese leadership. And this was seen as a turn, perhaps, toward Taiwan. Since then, though, President Trump has backed off on pressing China. I mean, one of the big ways the U.S. can press China is via Taiwan. Since the summit last month between President Trump and President Xi Jinping of China at the Mar-a-Lago estate, Trump has said that we have very good relations with China, and essentially he's backed off a lot of his promises during the campaign to press China. So, for example, he said that during his first day in office that he would label China a currency manipulator. He has since backed off of that. And so I think China now sees this as an opening around the world. China sees Trump's support, or at least lack of resistance, as an opening around the world to try to further isolate Taiwan, which seems to be what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Another facet of this, quickly comment on this. We have a number of other things to get to, but Jonathan, this week we heard that Donald Trump adding 6 more trademarks in China in sectors, veterinary services, construction, seen as a move that will likely help expand his business influence across China. I was reading that Trump has now over 100 registered or approved trademarks across China. So these are things that the Trump name is on, and he gets money for them.
That's right. And he said that, you know, he would recuse himself from his businesses. He hasn't fully done that. And it's also the case that these registrations for trademarks have been languishing for many years inside the Chinese system. The Chinese government had been sitting on them for a long time until Donald Trump was elected president. And then suddenly they all got approved. A cynical observer would say that this is perhaps a way for the Chinese government to financially reward Donald Trump for not pressing China too hard.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump facing yet another lawsuit connected with what this whole area we're talking about over profits his business empire brings in from dealings with foreign governments. The latest this week from nearly 200 Democratic members of the House and Senate joining a suit filed actually today in federal court in Washington, the 4th pending lawsuit, at least the 4th, alleging that Trump is violating the Foreign Emoluments Clause in the Constitution. Donna, perhaps you can jump in there and remind us what this clause in the Constitution is and what the Democrats hope to achieve with yet another lawsuit.
Yeah, it's that the president can't benefit financially from foreign entanglements, essentially, unless they get permission of Congress. One of the things that these kinds of lawsuits always have as a challenge is the issue of standing. So these 200 members of Congress that are filing this suit still have to pass the standing issue. Can they show that they're actually being harmed by this case or controversy? And they're making the case, as I understand it, that because Congress is involved in terms of allowing presidents to do this potentially, that they would have standing. We'll see if the court buys that. We also earlier in the week had D.C. and Virginia filing similar kinds of foreign emoluments cases as well. And so these are certainly things that are going to be litigated. But, you know, this was something essentially that was put there by the people who wrote the Constitution to make sure that, you know, essentially foreign governments couldn't have undue sway on a president.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, though, this is really in the background because we have all of the Russia investigations in the foreground. If these Russia investigations were not there, it would be a bigger deal, right? We just have so much happening, don't we?
Right. There would be a lot of things that we might be talking about in headlines. You know, healthcare, for example, is one of the ones that I think we'll talk about too today.
Yes, we want to get to that in a moment. But as I promised, I wanted to reach out to our listeners. If they had a question or a comment about what we've heard previously in this hour, to please call 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Tom in Des Moines. Tom, you wanted to talk, had a question about something we talked about earlier in the hour.
Yes, it's always amazing what people don't talk about. When you find where the silence is, then you find out sometimes where the problems are in our democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the Republican Party, which has not, Republicans in general and Congress have not reacted to the president saying that he has desires to fire Bob Mueller as the chief counsel. And, of course, this is all within his little news bubble. He's getting reinforcements from Sean Hannity and other people who say that this is totally baseless. But he obviously doesn't understand the rule of law. And we need to have people in his party telling him, educating him. You know, we've got the Speaker of the House and some others saying, well, he just hasn't learned anything. Well, someone has to teach him how important the rule of law is to our democratic society. And we haven't heard anything from the Republicans who, you know, need to say something very strong, exhibit some tough love towards our president and say, well, if you manage to fire Bob Mueller the way you fired Jim Comey, then we will enact a special law that appoints a special prosecutor for you. Mm-hmm. So we don't hear anything like that. And I also want to take this opportunity to condemn Steve King and his remarks about how the violence today is representative of democratic values. When are the people of his district going to realize that he represents not the best of his people, and I'm tempted to say the worst, but I won't say it, something much less than the best.
Okay,
they need to understand what he's all about.
Tom, thanks for your call from Des Moines. Let's talk about the Affordable Care Act before the hour gets away from us. Update on that yesterday. Donald Trump directing Senate Republicans to pass a generous health care bill at a meeting with more than a dozen GOP senators. The president arguing that the austere House health bill has is a difficult one to defend. The president also said that Republicans risk getting savaged in the upcoming 2018 midterms if they fail to repeal Obamacare after what was a seven-year campaign against the law. Interesting remarks yesterday. Let's listen to Charles Grassley. Earlier this week, our senator is speaking with Iowa Public Radio about the new draft of what is the AHCA, arguing that when the Democrats had control of the Senate, Majority Leader Harry Reid acted secretly also to push through Obamacare.
You know, it may not be right for us to do the same thing, but time may be a factor. If time isn't a factor, we'll have a hearing. If time is a factor, you may not have a hearing.
Okay, so we have Charles Grassley there. The president coming out this week saying the House bill too austere, I think mean was the word that was used, Donna. We have to remember, though, too, Donna, that Donald Trump threw a party in the Rose Garden celebrating the passage of the House bill, then calling it terrific, now calling it mean.
Yeah, and it was unusual at the time when the president had this Rose Garden ceremony because the bill had only passed one chamber of Congress. But it was a way to signify to the public that, hey, we've gotten something done. Of course, that's only part of the path to getting a bill to actually become law. And so now the task falls to the Senate to try to craft something that will satisfy how they're bringing this bill up, which is through reconciliation. It puts a time pressure on this that they have to have it done in this budget year, but it allows the bill not to be filibustered in the Senate. It could pass with 51 votes. The Republicans in the Senate only have a 52-person majority. They could afford to lose two because it could garner 50 Republicans, and Vice President Pence could come in and break the tie. But they are crafting this bill without even the broad Republican conference in the Senate knowing exactly what is in it. So some of these various things are leaking out about what potentially is in it. We didn't have the scoring from CBO, for example, of the House bill before they passed it. This is being done in secret. There was actually a quote from an anonymous staffer working on this effort when asked about why weren't they doing more of this out in the open, said, "We aren't stupid." That would seem to connote that much of what's in this bill is not going to be particularly popular. The Republicans are in a difficult position because their base certainly wants them to have something here that repeals the Affordable Care Act. But at the same time, how they do that might be very unpopular with the public. And as you mentioned, the 2018 elections are looming. That could very much be a referendum on the president, on the Republicans who control all the elected branches of government, in which the Democrats could potentially have some big gains.
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, how do you see this, the crafting of the GOP, the Senate version of the reform and replace?
I mean, it's like trying to get water out of a stone. I mean, you know, the problem is as Donna has mentioned, is that the Senate has to use reconciliation to get this through, which means in part, due to the Senate rules, that any bill that they propose, any legislation they propose, won't be allowed to increase the deficit. And so they essentially one of President Trump's complaints about the bill that he now says is too mean and earlier said was terrific was that it doesn't spend enough money on health care. But the senators can't really add more money on health care without also, say, raising offsetting taxes, because that would increase the deficit, according to various scoring. And then the Senate parliamentarian would likely rule that it can't be done by reconciliation. And so essentially, the Republicans are in a tough spot. I mean, they have to somehow come up with a way to reduce premiums while also preserving pre-existing health care coverages, not increasing health care spending, and reshape something like 17% of the U.S. economy. This is a massive exercise. It took the Democrats years to craft the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and the Republicans are trying to do it in a matter of weeks. And I don't know if it's going to happen.
Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. Our final 5 minutes or so of this Politics Wednesday. Let's go back to the phones. Bob with us in Muscatine. Bob, I think you wanted to go back to our comments on Bob Mueller earlier in the program, the special counsel investigating the Russia connections in the 2016 campaign. Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, sure. I'm kind of confused on this because this morning I heard on NPR that the White House came out and said they weren't going to fire Mueller. So I checked it again after hearing your guest, and I got the Hill on the Internet, and they said, quoted Huckabee saying they have no intention of firing Mueller. Mm-hmm. So I'm not quite sure
what the discussion is. Yeah, well, I repeated that, too, that I think Sarah Huckabee said that the president, in her words, has every right to fire him. He has no intention of doing so. But I guess the big Washington talk was about the fact that a close friend, Christopher Ruddy, had said that the president was weighing the termination of Special Counsel Robert Mueller.
Well, yeah.
So I guess that's what it's all about.
I thought he put it to bed pretty well last night, but I guess if the narrative's going to say fire him, I guess we can't do anything about that.
All right, Bob. Thank you for calling in Muscatine. We appreciate your call.
Okay, no problem.
All right. Let's talk a little bit before we go. This week, also news, the court battles over Donald Trump's revised travel ban continue to be waged across the country. Two cases have made it to the appeals court, one in the Ninth Circuit, the other in the Fourth Circuit. On Monday, the latest development, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling largely to uphold a Hawaii court's nationwide preliminary injunction that blocked the revised ban's 90-day halt on nationals from the six designated Muslim-majority nations and a 120-day suspension of the refugee program. So this, Donna, leaves this in the hands of the Supreme Court for the final say?
Potentially. The Trump administration has asked the Supreme Court to reinstate the travel ban. Both of these circuit court opinions, the Fourth and the Ninth, haven't discussed the merits of the case as we would talk about it, but have kept the injunction there. And so the Trump administration is certainly asking the Supreme Court to weigh in on that particular issue.
Mm-hmm. Other big news abroad this week in Moscow, other Russian cities. On Monday, we had riot police with batons breaking up anti-corruption protests, detaining hundreds of demonstrators. This was before a court sentenced to the opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, to his second prison term this year. Protests that were called by Navalny. It's a strong critic of the Russian president. These, Jonathan, were, I understand, some of the biggest protests in Russia since 2012. Observations, especially since Russia, in a different facet, is at the center of our political news here in the United States.
Indeed. Well, the Russian economy has been suffering quite badly from the sanctions that the U.S. And Europe put on after Russia's incursion in Ukraine. And so it seems that Vladimir Putin, the Russian president's popularity is slipping, although it's difficult to get an accurate opinion poll done in Russia. I mean, apparently he's still very popular. He has perhaps 80% approval rating, which, of course, any Western politician would kill for. But by Russian standards, it seems to be slipping. And there does seem to be increasing economic discontent and increasing discontent about the massive levels of corruption inside the Russian government. President Putin himself has been linked to various corrupt practices. When the Panama Papers came out last year, it was revealed that a lot of his personal friends, including a childhood friend who's a cellist inside the Moscow Symphony Orchestra, was somehow a billionaire overseas. The speculation was that this was, in part was Putin's money. And I think, the Russians, as the economy deteriorates, are at least some people are getting fed up. Yeah. Putin, unfortunately, is reacting as he tends to do by cracking down.
Mm. And finally, we can mention this. On Sunday, First Lady Melania Trump, her son, Barron Trump, officially moving into the White House. reuniting the first family full-time in Washington 5 months after the president's inauguration. This is the president's youngest son, 11 years old. They remained in New York so he could finish out his school year while the president moved to Washington. I wondered, Donna Hoffman, we know traditionally first ladies take up a cause. Have we seen Melania Trump take up any causes or mention any likely causes?
We haven't lately. She did at one point talk about anti-bullying. I believe that was during the campaign. It is unusual that it has taken this long for the first family to move into the White House. It is also unusual that she has been quite reticent in terms of her public statements. She did, however, step out a little bit when they went to went on their foreign tour a couple of weeks ago. So there's no recent word on what her portfolio, if we want to think about it that way, might be. Certainly, first ladies can choose a number of different things. And Michelle Obama, of course, had anti-obesity before her. Laura Bush had literacy. You know, first ladies going back to even Eleanor Roosevelt have had various things that they try to tackle and use the power of the office of the first lady, which is mostly symbolic, let's recognize, to, you know, further their cause, bring attention to particular issues. So no word really yet in terms of what she might talk about. And also it's notable that she's still in the process of hiring some staff to help further whatever this portfolio might be.
Okay, we've run out of time. Thank you very much for your insights this week, for stepping into our studio. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa and Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University. Jonathan, Donna, it's been a pleasure to have you this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to all our listeners who contributed questions and comments as well. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Help today from Chris Fenton in Cedar Falls. And in Ames, I think we had help from Jason Burns. The executive producer of River to River is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.